You're listening to KPFA 94.1 in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 in Berkeley, and KFCF 88.1 in Fresno.
Good morning. It is Thursday, October 26, 2017. This is Up Front. I'm Kat Brooks.
And I'm Brian Edwards Tiekert. Starting off the show, State Senator Jerry Hill sits on two committees that oversee utilities in this state. He says if Pacific Gas and Electric turns out to have been responsible for the wildfires in Northern California, the state should put them out of business.
And on the second half of the first hour, we will talk to Carolyn Suffren about her book, Jail Care, examining the types of health care that women can get behind bars that often they can't access on the other side.
And an in-depth report from our producer, Lucy King, on the raid against the homeless encampment in South Berkeley that took place yesterday. We'll look at what happened.
And then we're going to spend some time talking about the cost of traffic tickets, which can often be much more than the fine, especially if you're low income or people of color. We are going to be talking to Teresa Zenn, staff attorney at the Clean Slate Practice of the East Bay Community Law Center, about their ability to pay primer for advocates that they have put out and new legislation that can help people make their way through that.
We should take some calls on that, too.
We will take
some
calls.
There's probably people out there fighting traffic tickets.
Right this second.
That's all next.
After the news.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. House Republicans are focusing squarely on tax cuts rather than deficit discipline as they look to shoehorn a GOP budget plan through the House. Passage of the $4 trillion measure would pave the way for Republicans controlling Washington to pass a 10-year, $1.5 trillion tax cut measure later this year. But GOP leaders were scrambling to overcome pockets of resistance to the measure from hard-right Republicans unhappy about deficits and lawmakers from New York and New Jersey who fear the subsequent tax bill would take away a deduction for state and local taxes that's especially valuable to their constituents. Ways and Means Committee Chairman Kevin Brady says he'll schedule a panel debate and vote once the budget plan is safely passed. The Senate passed the measure last week. The budget is expected to cut billions from Medicare, Medicaid, and other social programs. President Trump is expected to announce today during a major speech on the opioid epidemic that he will direct his Department of Health and Human Services to declare the crisis a nationwide public health emergency under the Public Health Service Act. That's according to senior White House officials who briefed reporters on condition of anonymity. The declaration does not come with specific funding, but officials say it will allow changes such as expanded access to medical services in rural areas. Republican Congressman Harold Rogers of Kentucky told C-SPAN he's glad Trump is calling attention to the problem.
We're losing to an overdose now, one American every few minutes, like 15 minutes or so, and it's going unabated and it's increasing. And there's more people dying now from prescription drugs overdoses than car wrecks or gun violence.
Trump said an emergency designation will give his administration, quote, the power to do things that you can't do right now. Trump pledged during his campaign to make fighting addiction a top priority at rallies in some of the hardest hit states in the country. New security screenings for all passengers on U.S.-bound flights began today, with airlines worldwide questioning flyers about their trip and their luggage in the latest Trump administration decision affecting global travel. However, confusion still remains about the new regulations, which come at the end of a 120-day period following the United States lifting a ban on laptops and airplane cabins, affecting 10 Mideast cities. The new regulations cover all the 2,100 flights from around the world entering the U.S. on any given day. Some airlines said they had received permission to delay implementing the new rules until January. In March, U.S. officials introduced the laptop ban in the cabins of some Mideast airlines over concerns Islamic State fighters and other extremists could hide bombs inside of them. The ban was lifted after those airlines began using devices like CT scanners to examine electronics before passengers boarded planes headed to the U.S. Some also increasingly swab passengers' hands to check for explosives residue. President Trump is being coy about what people will see from long-secret JFK assassination-era files. A 1992 law requires the release today of all files that are still hidden on Kennedy's killing on November 22nd of 1963. Only the president can decide to hold some of those back. Trump's tweet on the eve of the release did not tip his hand. He merely noted that the files are coming out and added, quote, so interesting. Scholars and sleuths want every scrap of information out on the event, but intelligence agencies are said to be pushing back against complete disclosure. Whatever documents emerge, they're not expected to quell much of the conspiracy theorizing that swirls around the event. Kenyan police today fired bullets and tear gas at stone-throwing protesters in some opposition areas during the repeat of the disputed presidential election, reflecting bitter divisions in a country whose main opposition leader urged followers to boycott the vote. Three people were killed in protests, a police source said, one in the opposition stronghold of Kisumu County, another in Homa Bay in the west, and the third in Athi River town outside the capital of Nairobi. Protesters set fires and blocked roads in Kisumu, where 25 were reportedly injured during clashes with police. The injuries included many gunshot wounds. Violence also erupted in Nairobi's Kibera slum. Election officials said not a single ballot box was delivered to central Kisumu's 190 polling stations. Officials sat with the uncollected boxes in a school guarded by security forces. Opposition leader Raila Odinga, who got nearly 45% of the vote in August against President Uhuru Kenyatta, has said the new election won't be credible because of a lack of electoral reform. In response to the sort of violence seen at protests in places like Charlottesville, Virginia, and Berkeley, California, the Los Angeles City Council's Public Safety Committee on Wednesday unanimously backed a proposed ordinance to ban torches, mace, baseball bats, and other items that could be used as weapons at public protests. Civil liberties advocates say the move could violate free speech rights. KPFK's Dan Fritz has more.
The ACLU questions the legality of any ordinance that attempts to strip rights solely from those engaged in constitutionally protected activities. Councilmember Mitch Englander says he doesn't understand why anyone would be opposed to what he sees as common sense public safety reform.
For those that argue that people should have the right to bring all of these items to public events, particularly for protests, chains and nunchucks and martial art weaponry and box cutters. I just don't understand their argument.
Deputy City Attorney Julie Raffish told the council committee that the city's ordinance has already faced scrutiny.
That section was upheld by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal against First Amendment challenges and vagueness challenges in 2003.
At least one member of the council wanted to go further and ban masks or scarves so people can't cover their faces at protests. But the ordinance the council is expanding only applies to weapons. Dan Fritz, Pacifica Radio, KPFK, Los Angeles.
California Attorney General Javier Becerra says he will continue to press a lawsuit seeking to restore health care subsidies cut off by the Trump administration, even after a judge refused to grant an emergency request to resume the payments. Becerra said in a statement on Wednesday that the payments were critical to keeping health care costs affordable for Californian working families. Sunny and warm today in the San Francisco Bay Area, highs in the mid-80s, lows tonight in the low 50s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny with highs in the upper 80s. I'm Max Pringle. News returns at 7:30 on KPFA.
You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. We're now more than 2 weeks out from the start of the most destructive firestorms ever to hit our region. The confirmed death toll stands at 42. More than 8,700 buildings destroyed, most of them homes. And now we're starting to get a picture of how it started. A Bay Area News Group team went through dispatch recordings and found that emergency crews were sent to respond to up to 10 reports of sparking electrical wires and transformers in at least 10 separate locations during the high wind period when the fire started. After that reporting surfaced, PG&E no-showed on an interview that they had scheduled with us. And since then, they declined our interview requests. The company has circulated a statement suggesting its power lines were impacted by a, quote, historic wind event. Weather experts we've spoken to since then have said the wind was strong, not historically so. So the question is, what next? In theory, it is the job of California Public Utilities Commission to investigate and regulate the power company. They have opened an investigation. Then there's the practice. Jackson Vanderbexen at NBC pulled a 2015 audit from the PUC, documented over 3,500 instances of delayed maintenance in the fire-impacted areas. The total amount of fines that resulted from that audit, zero. We're joined now by one of PG&E's biggest watchdogs in the state legislature. Senator Jerry Hill represents the 13th district that includes San Bruno, where PG&E gas pipeline explosion killed 8 people in 2010. He now serves on the Senate Subcommittee on Gas, Electric, and Transportation Safety, also the Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Communications. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
From where you sit, what are the open questions about Pacific Gas and Electric's role in the fires?
Well, the open questions, I think, are what they have been doing historically with that area, with fire and vegetation management, and how they've protected their infrastructure against the potential of stronger winds and certainly downed power lines or downed trees and just the wind and the effect of that. And we don't know yet. The investigation certainly is a little premature in determining the exact cause. Cal Fire will conduct that, and I know they're very methodical and do an excellent job of locating the starting point of that fire, or those fires, actually. We do know that there was no lightning in the area at the time, so it appears to be from electrical shorts and wires that are down. But I think after the investigation there, it will go to the Public Utilities Commission if it's determined that it was a wire and a spark that caused it, and then they will do their investigation to then kind of get into the details, to find out the history of that area in terms of the vegetation management, about the money that has been spent, whether it was spent appropriately. And that's really where we will, kind of peel back the onion to the point where we can see if they've done the job that they were supposed to do, and if they spent the money, the ratepayer money that we gave them, appropriately and did it. The sad part is they don't have a good history with that. And Brian, what we've seen in 3 previous instances, going back to the time of the rough and ready fire of the 1990s, when they had that fire, we found afterwards that did not spend the money that was given to them for vegetation management and proper maintenance. They diverted that to bonuses and plans for executives and profits. And we saw that in the San Bruno explosion of 2010. They had diverted about $500 million, $500 million, from money that was supposed to be for proper testing and maintenance to profits and bonuses and the same thing. And then in the Butte Fire of 2015, we saw a very similar allegations were made, and you can connect the dots. And I'm hoping that that's not evident in this case. My fear is that they cut corners to change and deferred funds that were supposed to be used for maintenance and put it someplace else. And if that's the case, then I've really come to the conclusion that they've crossed the line and frankly shouldn't be allowed to do business in California again or any longer.
What does that mean, they shouldn't be allowed to do business in California? They own the electrical infrastructure for a big chunk of the state.
They do own the infrastructure, but there are ways of taking that away from them or selling that. The eminent domain could do it. Cities could take it individually and purchase it or bond against it and yet take the infrastructure. The legislature could order that done. The PUC could do it. The legislature could here again direct the PUC to take over PG&E. It is the largest utility in the state, but they've claimed that the estimates for the damage that was done, if they're held liable for that, it could be as high as $12 billion. Well, they don't have $12 billion, and that may force them into bankruptcy. If it did, then out of bankruptcy there could be some arrangements made where the government does takes over control or purchases it some way. It's a little too early to tell, but frankly, I'm willing to take the chance as we develop and look at different angles and opportunities there, because if what we see proves out, or if it is their responsibility and negligence to the extent that they diverted funds, again, we won't be able to trust them in the future. And I believe in the best interest of California, they can't be allowed to exist. When you look at the 42 deaths and is it now 8,400 structures and homes have been lost, we can't take a chance in the future with them. And so I think there are opportunities and ways of looking at changing their structure in the future.
Expropriating a multi-billion-dollar utility company would be a pretty bold move. What is your sense of how much support for measures like that there is in Sacramento?
Well, that remains to be seen. Certainly the utilities and PG&E especially are very powerful in California, and especially in Sacramento and with the legislature. They have a very loud voice, and it's listened to. So it would be difficult. It would be a challenge. But I don't think any of the current sitting members of the legislature have experienced nor have they seen the devastation that we've seen in the last few weeks anywhere. I mean, our hearts are broken for those people. And I know the legislators who are dealing with it there are working day and night to make sure that their constituents are served the best way possible. But, I mean, this is unheard of devastation, unheard of loss for a state. And I think that demands a greater accountability and, at the end of the day, maybe out-of-the-box thinking in terms of the changes that may be necessary to make sure this doesn't happen again.
What's your degree of confidence in the investigation that will be done by the State Public Utilities Commission?
You know, I've been very pleased with the investigative work that they can do and that they have done. Certainly with San Bruno and the gas explosion, the National Transportation Safety Board came in, and they are the highest caliber of investigations, and we relied heavily on them for the determination of this. And perhaps we will need to do something beyond the PUC to make sure. But I think that if we find that if CAL FIRE determines the location and the cause, and then it gets into the weeds in determining how that developed, it more or less begins to look into a paperwork investigation and a resource investigation to see how they did the job that they did. And it's not as much as a technical as a forensic type of accounting investigation that I think the PUC can do adequately. And there will be pressure on them, certainly from me and others, to make sure that they spend the resources and do an adequate job.
Can you explain, you referenced previous incidents with Pacific Gas and Electric where large sums of money that had been intended to go into system maintenance had been diverted to things like shareholder profits and executive dividends. How does that work? Isn't there tight oversight on how ratepayer money gets spent and appropriated?
Well, there is, but there's no auditing in many cases of this, and the money is designed and allocated for certain expenditures, but there's no one that really goes back to make sure that money is all spent for that, or that, I mean, if you use San Bruno as an example, because it's probably the one that I know closely enough or much about, and that in that particular case, PG&E ignored appropriate testing, did not use the testing that was necessary, and they made their own interpretations of federal law, and no one challenged them on that. No one questioned the fact that they'd never hydrostatically pressure tested that line.
Whose job was it to challenge them on that?
That would have been the PUC's job to do that, and the federal government really authorizes the PUC to do that, and the PUC should have followed up on that. But it gets into the real details of every particular line, and at some point you have to rely on the utility to do the job that they're being paid to do and that the responsible thing. And that's where you know, I've become a little disillusioned with investor-owned utilities. I you know, the profit motive in here has, I think, been the fault, been the challenge and the problem of where we've seen in some of these disasters. It's a result of them cutting corners. They're guaranteed a rate of return. The PG&E, I think, now is at about 10.5% of a rate of return, which is a darn good return on their investment. And so they get 10.5%. The only way they can increase their profit and to look better to their shareholders is to cut corners. So they cut on expenditures, and by doing that, they can increase their profits, and they can give more bonuses to the high upper management. And so they create programs within the organization that they look good, and the program will be defined as actually creating a better and a safer and a more reliable system. But at the same time, by doing that, you are cutting some expenditures elsewhere that that could be have an impact at some point in time. No one thought that pipe in San Bruno was a problem. No one thought it had been there for over 50, 60 years, and that it should be safe. But no one had ever done the proper test to see if it was safe. And that's really people rely on their experience rather than on the appropriate testing, because as we know, safety, frankly, is not sexy. Safety is something that you know, you do because you want to prevent something, but you don't get much credit for it while you're doing it because nothing's happened, and that's the expected outcome. But it's a problem.
What about like the political economy problem? I mean, they spread around campaign money. They lobby. Bay Area News Group had a big investigation this week kind of chronicling Pacific Gas and Electric's efforts to push back on a plan to map all the fire hazards in their system, which they were largely successful in doing up till this point. It's something that might have prevented the fires.
They've been very successful in that, Brian, and that's the part that's very disturbing. We noticed that in 2015, the fire map. We had a hearing that the subcommittee I chair in the Senate looked at the fire maps, and after 7-8 years, they had done really nothing. And the fire map that was created didn't identify the area where the Butte fire occurred as a hazardous fire area. Interestingly, when we looked at that and came to the conclusion that it was there, we also pointed out that Cal Fire, and this is the part that's kind of interesting, is when we looked at the fire map and looked at what Cal Fire had said, they had their maps showed that there was were large areas and communities in Northern California that were not recognized in the fire map that the PUC claims, and these are areas that are, that we just saw the fires in the last 2 weeks that were not identified, still not identified in the work that the PUC did. And that's where the greatest risk obviously has been and identified. So we wrote a letter to then-Commissioner Florio kind of outlining these problems of the fire map. To me, they've spent 10 years now on this, and it has been a complete waste of time. They need to go in a different direction is what we've seen. But you're absolutely right in terms of the power and the force of the utilities in Sacramento. They do fund campaigns and the campaign contributors. They also are very involved in independent expenditures during election times. They're a big player in Sacramento. I don't know if that how that equates to votes and everything. It just really shows that they do invest a lot in the political process.
Right. I mean, so that raises a bigger question, right? We can imagine a scenario where the investigation into these fires concludes that PG&E was reasonably compliant with the regulations as they existed. But if PG&E's also been using its money and its political influence to keep those regulations weaker than they should be, it's got a moral culpability that's falling short of a legal culpability. That's still something that demands a political solution, isn't it?
does, but it's a tough political solution to deal with a moral dilemma like that, or a moral focus that comes back. It's, you know, the regulators themselves, when you look at the Public Utilities Commission, and I at this point with the new leadership, now going back a few years before we changed the leadership, and that was, we fought hard to make those changes. The governor has made some very responsible appointments, and his most recent two, I think, are very responsible and will do an excellent job. They're rarely influenced by the political contribution part of it, or the political influence of the utilities. What their challenge is, and this is where I think we need to think outside the box, is they're fearful that and it has been raised by the president of the PUC that PG&E is too big to fail. And just taking on that same mantra from the banking industry of a few years ago, we can't allow them to fail because we have no alternative. And even if we fine them too much money, that will put them in a financial distress. Their bond rating will go down, therefore their cost of borrowing will go up, and the ratepayers will pay for that. So there's this tendency to walk on thin ice when you're talking and dealing with the utilities, because you don't want to harm them too much. You don't want to hurt them. I think it's time that we need to take a chance and responsibly look at breaking up those, going back to an old phrase, breaking up those boxes a little bit, or challenging PG&E and to a point where if they go bankrupt, then that's okay. We'll work around that. But I mean, we need to do it delicately, and we need to do it the right way. But the way we're doing it today just isn't working. The utilities are too big, and they're able, because of that, and because of the fear that's involved, they're allowed to write some of the agenda, and that's not right.
It's a big political liability, though, isn't it? Say regulation forces them into bankruptcy, the state is in the process of taking over their infrastructure, and then there's blackouts.
Well, and that's where I mean, that's when I said gingerly, we have to walk very carefully and responsibly. If we were to do anything like that, has to be done with a very thoughtful approach. But I do think that at some point, and it even goes back to when you talk about fining the utilities, the PUC fined them $1.4 billion for the San Bruno experience and that tragedy. And that fine, there was sensitivity. Well, if the ratepayers are not paying that, which is the way it should be, but the shareholders are, well, who are the shareholders? The shareholders are, someone's grandmother that's dependent upon that money for their livelihood. I mean, it gets down to that fact. Is who's paying this money are people who are reliant on the dividends from PG&E for their existence. I mean, that's the sensitivity that I believe a lot of people are looking at. And I just think it's time that we go beyond that. Because the system related to our utilities in California, especially with PG&E, because of its size, is not serving the people of California, and it's a dangerous situation. And that's, here again, speculation based on an investigation and a conclusion that we don't know of. But if things go as historically have, I think that's where it will lead.
Well, we will certainly watch that investigation. If past is prologue, it will not be a fast one. Jerry Hill, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Brian. Thank you.
Jerry Hill is a state senator representing District 13. That includes San Bruno, where a gas pipeline explosion in a pipeline owned by Pacific Gas and Electric killed 8 people in 2010. He now serves on the Subcommittee on Gas, Electric, and Transportation Safety, and also on the Senate's Energy, Utilities, and Communications Committee.
It is 7:29 in the morning. You are listening to Up Front. I'm Kat Brooks with Brian Edwards Tiekert. This Saturday is the 10th annual Life is Living Festival at Defermery Park in West Oakland from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Festival is free for all and includes a kids zone, people's groceries, free breakfast program, community African dance, Cal Shakes live theater stage, performances by Kev Choice, Young Gifted in Black, Los Racas, and more. Be there. And then up next, we are going to talk to Carolyn Suffren about the types of medical care that are often available to women who are incarcerated that they can't find on the streets.
Oh, my God, that is so terrible.
That your existence inside of jail might be better for at least your physical health, than it is once you walk outside.
Your only shot at single-payer health care.
Yes, actually, it is the only shot you have in this country at single-payer health care. So we'll talk about all of that and much, much more with Carolyn Suffren after these news. Also, so the Life is Living festival, just a little bit more about Life is Living. It's actually, it's not just a festival. It's recognized as a national model for community engagement and audience development. And partner cities have included Chicago, Houston, New York, Philadelphia, Norfolk, and Atlanta, and really relives, celebrates the history of the Black Panther Party in Oakland, which is why it takes place in the West.
Well, we'll get into that jail care interview in just a second after the news.
As we are learning more, and I think we're going to about the way the Russians...
Okay. I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. House Republicans are focusing squarely on tax cuts rather than deficit discipline as they look to shoehorn a GOP budget plan through the House. Passage of the $4 trillion measure would pave the way for Republicans controlling Washington to pass a 10-year, $1.5 trillion tax cut measure later this year. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders recently called the GOP plan the cruelest budget ever.
Income and wealth inequality, this budget provides $1.9 trillion in tax breaks for the top 1%. At a time when millions of working families are struggling to keep their heads above water, this budget cuts Medicaid by $1 trillion. 15 million Americans could lose their health insurance.
Meanwhile, GOP leaders were scrambling to overcome pockets of resistance to the measure from hard right Republicans unhappy about deficits and lawmakers from New York and New Jersey who fear the subsequent tax bill would take away a deduction for state and local taxes that's especially valuable to their constituents. New security screenings for all passengers on U.S.-bound flights began today, with airlines worldwide questioning flyers about their trip and their luggage in the latest Trump administration decision affecting global travel. However, confusion still remains about the new regulations, which come at the end of a 120-day period following the United States lifting a ban on laptops in airplane cabins, affecting 10 Mideast cities. The new regulations cover all the 2,100 flights from around the world entering the U.S. on any given day. Some airlines said they had received permission to delay implementing the new rules until January. California's Supreme Court won't reconsider its decision upholding a voter-approved measure meant to speed up executions in the state. The court voted 5-2 in August to uphold Proposition 66, but ruled that the measure's provision for a 5-year deadline for condemned inmates' appeals was advisory and not mandatory. Anti-death penalty activists had asked the court to reconsider its August ruling. The court declined the request Wednesday with no comment, saying its August decision was final. The measure requires more lawmakers to take death penalty appeals that will be assigned almost immediately after sentencing. California has 400 such appeals already pending. Sunny and warm today in the San Francisco Bay Area, highs in the mid-80s, lows tonight in the lower 50s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny with highs in the upper 80s. I'm Max Pringle. News returns at 8 on KPFA.
Good morning. You are listening to Upfront. I am Kat Brooks. We rarely think of jail as a safety net for women, but for pregnant women, and particularly Black women, it is where they can find health care where they had none before. And despite the punitive nature of jails, it's a place where they can take care of their unborn, receive food and shelter and medical care. Carolyn Suffren discusses these contradictions in her book, Jail Care, Finding the Safety Net for Women Behind Bars. Carolyn is a medical anthropologist and obstetrician gynecologist at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Good morning, Carolyn.
Good morning, Kat.
Thank you so much for joining us. You spent 4 years inside of the San Francisco County Jail. How did you come to work there?
Well, I actually sought out the opportunity to work at the San Francisco jail when I moved there because before that I was in Pennsylvania and I was doing my medical training in OBGYN. And I had an experience one night when I was on call as a resident where I was delivering the baby of a woman who was shackled to the bed. I'm just going to pause for the listeners to let that sink in. So I was delivering the baby of a woman, and she was shackled to the bed. And I never in my wildest dreams could have imagined that this was something, as a physician, I was going to confront. And it made me realize that, wait a second, there are women who are incarcerated, and there are pregnant women. I became really interested in learning more about who these women are behind bars and how they're treated, and how I, as a physician, could try to maybe contribute and make some things better. I actually sought out the medical director of the San Francisco jail and asked if I could spend some time at the jail. So that's how I started working there. It was really that clinical experience of having my eyes open very widely to some of the injustices that happen in our country that most people don't think about.
When I read that sentence in your book that she was shackled while she was giving birth, I wanted to know, did they unshackle her so that she can she could hold her child?
No, this woman was never unshackled, and it also spoke to the fact that I, as a physician, even though I was someone who, you know, our culture gives physicians a lot of power and authority, whether that's warranted or not. That's often how it is in our society. And yet I felt extremely disempowered, and, you know, there was a guard with weapons on his belt, and I did not feel...
In the birthing room?
Mm-hmm. And I did not feel like I could ask him to unshackle this woman, and he was in the room. Now, that is not always the case. Sometimes there is always a guard who is with an incarcerated patient when they go to the hospital, pregnant or not.
And that's a really vulnerable... I've given birth. That's like the most vulnerable, private, personal moment a woman could have. To have a male guard you don't know with a weapon next to your bed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And it can be extremely traumatizing, and in many cases re-traumatizing, because... So many incarcerated women have experienced prior sexual, physical, or emotional trauma, up to 90%. And so having a person of authority who has, you know, who's in uniform, who is part of the police state, who is part of the institution that's incarcerating you right now, having them in the room as a reminder and also as someone who doesn't know you is incredibly invasive.
Now, when you came to San Francisco County, what were the conditions of healthcare inside of the jail there for pregnant women?
So San Francisco, as some of the listeners might imagine, is unusual in that the healthcare services provided there, both when I started and now, are actually relatively good. Now, they are by no means perfect, and certainly the women who are in the San Francisco jail right now have many complaints. About the care, and there are many ways it could be better. But compared to jails and prisons across the country, the health care there is actually fairly good and fairly up to community standards. And so what that looks like, and what it looked like when I started at the San Francisco jail, they had physicians and nurse practitioners who were providing medical care, and they had a nurse practitioner who specialized in women's health, who was providing most of the women's health care. There was not an OBGYN doctor on site at the jail, but if there were any issues that needed the attention of an OBGYN, then pregnant patients would be transported to the county hospital nearby. When I started there, pregnant women got prenatal care provided by the women's health nurse practitioner. It was provided on a regular basis. She's very well trained and very skilled. They got all the appropriate recommended testing during pregnancy. They were counseled on their options. If a pregnant woman didn't want to be pregnant, she had access to abortion services at the county hospital if that's what she chose. And if a woman went into labor while she was at the jail, they promptly transported her to the county hospital where she gave birth. So things were in fairly good shape when I was there, and when I first got there, and I was able to provide additional services as an OBGYN on site and to expand access to various reproductive health care services. But I want to make sure that listeners know, and also readers of the book know, that this is not necessarily typical across the country, and at many jails and prisons across the country, women's health needs, especially their reproductive health needs, and especially their pregnancy care needs, are often neglected or the care they receive is very bare bones. And, you know, it doesn't happen often, but it does happen sometimes where women's labor complaints are ignored and they end up giving birth in their jail cell. And so while what I describe in the book and what I observed at the San Francisco jail is, like I said, relatively good, it's not that way at many jails and prisons across the country.
But that's despite this lawsuit, right? This Estelle versus Gamble lawsuit, which this is an interesting conversation to have right now, given the conversation we're having about health care in the country. But people who are incarcerated, locked up, are the only people in the United States that are supposed to have a constitutional right to health care, correct?
Yes. And isn't that peculiar? Isn't that strange that, you know, you enter jail or prison, and as part of your punishment, you're stripped of most of your rights, yet you gain a right to health care that you don't otherwise have outside of jail or prison. And that case that you mentioned from 1976, Estelle versus Gamble, the Supreme Court deemed that not to attend to prisoners' serious medical needs is basically cruel and unusual punishment and violates the Constitution. And so what I think that signals is questions about what is the role of the prison, what is the role of the state, of government, to provide health care for its citizens. And if we have decided that incarcerated people have a right to health care, then what does that mean for non-incarcerated people in the United States? And what is the value of health care in the community compared to the value of health care in the prison or jail? Now, I should also add that even though Estelle versus Gamble established health care as a right for incarcerated people, it didn't provide any specificities as to what that health care should look like. Mm. It just said that prisons and jails have to tend to the, quote, serious medical needs. But what counts as a serious medical need is up to the discretion of the people in charge at any given prison or jail. And so that's why you get so much variability. There's just no required standardization and no mandatory oversight for what medical services jails and prisons have to provide.
What does advocacy, then, on behalf of pregnant women in jails look like? What are the things that jails should be doing?
Well, I think there are a number of levels to that. One is at a very basic, sort of as you alluded to, what should they be doing for the time that pregnant women are incarcerated? And I think that that has to entail having quality prenatal care provided by qualified providers, making sure that they have access to all the recommended national standards of care for various testing, ultrasound, and blood tests. Whatever pregnancy care she would get in the community, she should have access to while in the prison or jail as well. She should also receive that care with respect and dignity, and that's much harder to pinpoint and to ensure. But what I learned in my research, both in the San Francisco jail and also in talking to people who have been at other prisons or jails, is that the pregnant women are often very harshly judged by our society and also by the people who work there. They're harshly judged because they are incarcerated and pregnant, and so people call into question whether they can be quote-unquote good mothers, rather than looking at the broader circumstances that produce the reality that led them to be in the criminal justice system. Because most of these people are not violent criminals. Most of them are in life circumstances where their lives are characterized by poverty, by drug addiction, untreated mental illness, by unemployment, by racial injustice, by histories of trauma, things that are broader structural forces, not necessarily individual choices. We also must ensure that pregnant women who are incarcerated have access to abortion and have access to non-coercive abortion. We also need to make sure that pregnant women who are incarcerated are not forced to be sterilized after they give birth, but are instead given options for reversible, non-permanent methods of birth control if they want.
I'm sorry, Carolyn, I have to stop you right there. I just think we need to sit with that for a minute. Is that, in 2017, United States of America, are women being sterilized after they give birth in jail?
Yes. So,
how prevalent is that?
We don't know. We don't know because we don't know much about the health of pregnant incarcerated women and outcomes. But what we know is that in 2012 in the state of California, the organization Justice Now and an investigative reporter revealed that there were over 100 women who were unlawfully sterilized in the California prison system from 2006 to 2010. So we're not talking about the 1920s and the 1930s,
right,
the heyday of the eugenics movement. We are talking about now. As a result of that, California actually passed a law that prohibits sterilization procedures for anyone who's incarcerated. But this is not an isolated incident. We just don't know how often it's happening. Just a few weeks ago, we learned about a county in Tennessee where the sheriff and a judge is incentivizing incarcerated men and women to be sterilized, either with a vasectomy or tubal ligation, and getting reduced jail time if they agree to be sterilized. And that is just an unconscionable option. It's not an option, it's coercion. And so this is still happening. And these are legacies from the eugenics movement of coercing people into sterilization, into removing their ability to reproduce. And these are also legacies even as far back as slavery, when slave women's reproduction was controlled by their slave masters. If you think about it, and think about the fact that our prisons and jails disproportionately incarcerate women of color,
right,
you see the connections pretty quickly.
That's exactly what I was just thinking. I was like, and we're talking about black men and black women whose reproductive agency is being compromised by the state.
Absolutely.
You are listening to Upfront. I am Kat Brooks. We are speaking to Carolyn Suffren about her book, Jail Care, Finding the Safety Net for Women Behind Bars. Carolyn is a medical anthropologist and OBGYN at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Now, just because you're pregnant and you know, and you're in jail, you're still subjected to the punitive practices of jail, correct?
That's right. And so if you're pregnant and incarcerated in jail, you're still considered a prisoner, and you are still subject to all the rules of the institution that's housing you, and you are still treated as a potential safety risk, as a potential flight risk when you're taken off-site. And so that's why we even have to have a conversation about the shackling of pregnant women, because the presumption is that all prisoners are dangerous and therefore must be contained when they're taken off-site. So pregnant incarcerated women are still subject to all the same punitive structures of being incarcerated.
Does that include solitary confinement?
So that's an excellent question. And currently there are no laws that prohibit the use of restrictive housing, of solitary confinement with pregnant incarcerated women. However, we have good evidence to show that solitary confinement in general for non-pregnant people causes significant negative impact on their mental health. And this is also the case for pregnant women and can also potentially limit their access to regular medical care when they have an emergency, those sorts of things. And so just a few weeks ago, Senators Harris, Booker, Warren, and Durbin introduced a bill to the Senate, Dignity for Incarcerated Women, and that bill does have a provision in it that would prohibit the use of solitary confinement for pregnant women.
And I guess as I'm thinking about the solitary confinement, I was thinking about my OBGYN stressing it wasn't just, you know, what I ate, but it was also my mental and emotional health and the impact on my unborn child.
That's right. We know that stressful life circumstances and stressful environments can have an impact on the developing pregnancy in ways that are difficult to measure in some ways and in other ways are not. And so being pregnant and incarcerated is an extremely stressful experience. You're isolated from your usual support networks. You're fearful of what's going to happen, although you know that most likely you're going to be separated from your baby soon after birth. You may not have access to adequate nutrition or sleeping arrangements. There are many ways in which just being pregnant in this environment of deprivation is extremely stressful and can also potentially impact the outcomes of the pregnancy. But what we don't know, and I alluded to this earlier, but we don't know actually what happens to pregnancies in prison and jail. We actually don't have any updated statistics that tell us how many women give birth, how many pregnant women there are at any given time, how many women have miscarriages, stillbirths, abortions, neonatal deaths, maternal deaths, C-sections. We just don't know.
Why are we not collecting that data?
Well, there are a lot of potential explanations for this. One that some people might give is that there just aren't enough resources. There is a branch of the Department of Justice called the Bureau of Justice Statistics, and they are charged with collecting certain statistics, and they don't have enough resources to collect health-related data, certainly not on a regular basis. But more broadly, we have to think about the fact that we don't know about pregnant women, and what does that mean about how we value or don't value pregnant women behind bars? You know, they're so marginalized that they're forgotten. And so collecting data of them about them is kind of an afterthought. Now, this is something my research team at Johns Hopkins, we are in the midst of collecting these data right now. So we are in the midst of a one-year study collecting these outcomes data from 22 state prison systems, from the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and from the five largest jails. But, you know, this is something that I think should come from a more systematic level to collect these data so that we know what we're doing and what the outcomes are for pregnant women in custody.
Now, despite all this, you still talk about jail as a new safety net and jail care. Why?
Well, when I meet women like Evelyn and women like Kima, whom I describe in great detail in the book, and other women like them, when I meet them and they tell me that jail is the only place where they're getting prenatal care, where they say, we hate being in jail because it's jail, but at the same time, they know that this is the only place where they can get care, that is problematic. That is jail care. The fact that jail has become this place for them, and that it also reflects the broader deficiencies of our society and our safety net, where women who are predominantly poor, predominantly black, and marginalized by our society are so abandoned by the safety net, and their lives are so enmeshed in the criminal justice system, that jail, by default, has become a safety net for them. And even though violent things happen in jail, violent things happen to them in jail, some of them feel that it is still safer for them than their lives on the streets. And so Kima said to me on a number of occasions, my worst day in jail is better than my best day on the streets.
Right. And there was another quote, I can't remember if it was Kima or if it was Evelyn, that said, people say I got arrested, but was it rescued or saved?
Yes, Evelyn said that to me during her pregnancy, the third time in jail during her pregnancy. She felt that her life was just spiraling, and it was so dangerous, and she wasn't able to, she didn't have a place to sleep on the streets. The only food she had was scraps she found by the garbage. She didn't sleep for weeks at a time. She was using drugs that she didn't want to be using, but she... You know, addiction is a chronic disease, mm-hmm. And she didn't have the health care that she needed. And so when she came to jail, she felt like that helped her. That helped her get off drugs. It helped her get in prenatal care, at least temporarily, for the time being of her pregnancy. But that jail care that she got, the jail care that exists as a safety net, that's not the solution. That's not the answer. It's a symptom of the problems. And what we need to do is we need to invest in our social safety net services, our medical safety net services. We need to invest in valuing the lives of these poor women, of these women who are predominantly women of color, and of their children. And we need to invest in alternatives to incarceration and divert resources from our prisons and jails into community programs so that women like Evelyn and Kima don't feel like jail is the only place that they can turn to.
Do you know what happened to Evelyn?
I do. In fact, after not being in touch with her for 3 years, she found me out of the blue on Facebook. And Evelyn has not been back in jail in a year. She's trying. She's trying to get her life back together. She is, you know, trying to get into treatment. But, you know, there aren't enough resources to provide all the women like Evelyn who need mental health care and who need addiction treatment.
We've got, as a country anyway, the resources. It's just about where we're putting them. I do a lot of these interviews talking about women being incarcerated, and I always wonder about the impact on the children. So we talked about a little bit about the some known, some unknown impact of the unborn children. But once these women give birth to these babies, where do these babies go?
Well, it depends. But in most cases, the babies are going to end up going into foster care, into state systems. And that's really unfortunate that a child is starting out its life in the system. The best arrangement in many cases is if she has a family member or a trusted community member who can take care of the baby until she gets released from prison or jail.
But even that we find difficult, right, because a lot of times those family members are struggling themselves.
Exactly, and I observed that in the women that I came to know during my research and my clinical care in the jail. Kima, for instance, the baby she gave birth to while she was incarcerated in the San Francisco jail, she thought that her sister was going to be taking care of the baby for a couple of weeks. But it turns out her sister had an open case with Child Protective Services, and so that didn't work out. And then I also had another woman who the father of the baby was in her life and was not incarcerated himself, but he struggled with alcohol addiction, and she did not trust him to take care of their child. And so she didn't have anyone whom she could rely on to take care of the baby. Now, in some cases, there are a handful of prisons across the country where they have nursery programs within the prison, so separate wings of the prison for moms and their new babies so that the moms and babies can be together, sometimes as long as 18 months. And, you know, these nursery programs are sometimes heralded as a solution and as, you know, opportunities to promote mother-infant bonding, which we know has a tremendous amount of importance for the mother's and the baby's psychological health and development. But if you think about it, that child is starting its life in prison. And this mother is learning parenthood in an environment that's still a prison.
So what is the solution to that? Right. So if someone has broken the law and they're in jail, if they're pregnant, what are some alternatives?
Well, I think some alternatives would be community-based supervision, and there are some models for that. And in fact, San Francisco has begun investing in this for pregnant people in particular, and using that as a model. But having some kind of supervised housing arrangement where they are still, you know, showing up to whatever appointments or whatever surveillance they need, but that they're also at the same time provided with the appropriate resources for medical care, for addiction treatment, for mental health care, for women like Kima and Evelyn, who had struggled with addiction for most of their adult lives. This would mean having more residential treatment programs for pregnant women. And San Francisco does have a few, but as Evelyn, you know, told me, she really wanted to go to one of these programs, but she just kept saying, there were no beds. And there aren't enough of them. But there are a lot of alternatives to give them the best chance of success for raising their children with dignity and in health.
You are listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. We have been speaking with Carolyn Suffren about her book, Jail Care, Finding the Safety Net for Women Behind Bars. Carolyn is a medical anthropologist and an OBGYN at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Carolyn, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much, Kat. It's been a pleasure.
Et alors, c'est bon, c'est très bon. This is Chris Welch, delighted to let you know that Alice Waters will soon be celebrating her intimate new memoir, Coming to My Senses, The Making of a Counterculture Cook. It's so good. She'll be discussing her life and Chez Panisse and other wonderful things with the suave Steve Wasserman on Thursday evening, November the 16th at 7:30 p.m. They'll be at First Congregational Church, 2345 Channing Way in Berkeley. There is wheelchair access at this benefit for KPFA and the Edible Schoolyard Project. I get to host, mes amis, and she'll love seeing you there almost as much as you will love being there. November the 16th. Tickets at brownpapertickets.com and our cherished indie bookstores. A bientôt.
This is Upfront. You are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, and 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org.
Coming up on 8 o'clock in the morning here, and we have a packed second hour of the show coming up. First, we're going to take a look at what happened with the homeless camp eviction in South Berkeley yesterday. Our producer, Lucy King, had actually been speaking to people in the camp for a while before the eviction happened, was able to get there on scene while it was in progress, and has been following up on what's happening to people since they're displaced. So we're going to have a really in-depth report that she produced with our intern, Julia Reichardt. I'm super interested to find out what they learned because I live half a block away.
Right.
And then we're going to talk traffic tickets.
Expensive traffic tickets in the state of California. Higher than anywhere else in the country.
And I had not realized like how much of a class and race issue this is.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out, basically, when California fell into a fiscal crisis, one of the impacts was the courts became self-funding by just slapping fee after fee after fee onto traffic tickets. Who does it impact?
The people who get pulled over the most. Black and brown folks.
And the people who drive for a living. The people who have to commute the furthest. We've just found out that there have been several changes at the state level. There is now a process for knocking your ticket down based on your ability to pay. We're going to talk about how to take advantage of that. They can no longer suspend your license for not paying a ticket. We're going to take your calls on how to deal with the traffic ticket problems you may have in the second part of this hour. That's all coming up next after the news.
Hi, Max Pringle with these headlines. House Republicans are focusing squarely on tax cuts rather than deficit discipline as they look to shoehorn a GOP budget plan through the House today. A passage of the $4 trillion measure would pave the way for Republicans controlling Washington to pass a 10-year, $1.5 trillion tax cut measure later this year. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders recently called the GOP plan the cruelest budget ever.
At a time when millions of working families are struggling to keep their heads above water, this budget cuts Medicaid by $1 trillion. 15 million Americans could lose their health insurance.
Meanwhile, GOP leaders are scrambling to overcome pockets of resistance to the measure from hard-right Republicans unhappy about deficits and lawmakers from New York and New Jersey who fear the subsequent tax bill would take away a deduction for state and local taxes that's especially valuable to their constituents. Ways and Means Committee Chairman Kevin Brady says he'll schedule a panel debate and vote once the budget plan is safely passed. The Senate passed the measure last week. President Trump is expected to announce today during a major speech on the opioid epidemic that he will direct his Department of Health and Human Services to declare the opioid crisis a nationwide public health emergency under the Public Health Service Act. That's according to senior White House officials who briefed reporters on condition of anonymity. The declaration does not come with specific funding, but officials say it will allow changes such as expanded access to medical services in rural areas. Republican Congressman Harold Rogers of Kentucky told C-SPAN he's glad Trump is calling attention to the issue.
We're losing to an overdose now, one American every few minutes, like 15 minutes or so. And it's going unabated, and it's increasing. And there's more people dying now from prescription drugs overdoses than car wrecks or gun violence.
Trump said an emergency designation will give his administration the power to do things you can't do right now. Trump pledged during his campaign to make fighting addiction a top priority at rallies in some of the hardest-hit states in the country. Iraq's prime minister today dismissed a proposal from the country's Kurdish leaders to freeze the results of their independence vote last month as Iraqi government forces and Kurdish fighters traded fire near the country's border with Turkey. Haider al-Abadi's office released the comments as the prime minister met with Iranian officials in Tehran, including the Islamic Republic's supreme leader. The timing shows the importance Iran has in Iraq in the years since the 2003 American-led invasion, both culturally and in the war against the Islamic State group, even as Sunni Arab countries and the United States remain eager to pull Baghdad into their political orbit. Iraq's central government said it, quote, will accept only the cancellation of the referendum following the constitution. The Iraqi Kurdish referendum last month overwhelmingly backed independence from Baghdad. Kurdish authorities held the vote in three provinces that make up their autonomous region in northern Iraq, as well as in a string of territories claimed by Baghdad that were at the time controlled by the Kurds, including the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. The Trump administration says it doesn't support a $16 billion California water project as it is now proposed, but will keep working with the state as it develops the Twin Tunnels plan. Interior Department Deputy Communications Director Russell Newell said Wednesday the Trump administration has chosen not to move forward on Governor Jerry Brown's plan to build water tunnels to transfer water south from Northern California. In a statement later, he added that the agency supports California's efforts to make the state's water supply more reliable and environmentally sustainable. The Sonoma County Board of Supervisors and the Santa Rosa City Council have passed new housing-related laws to deal with the aftermath of the recent North Bay wildfires, which destroyed thousands of homes in the affected areas. And, as Corinne Smith reports, evidence of rental price gouging in the area have also prompted local government to take action.
Santa Rosa's new regulations are effective immediately and will prioritize home reconstruction, waive city fees, and allow residents to erect temporary structures on their property while rebuilding is underway. Vice Mayor Jack Tibbetts.
It's easy for us to talk about all the reasons why we need to elongate the timeline, but I didn't lose my home. And I really got to empathize with the person who lost their home just wants to get back in it.
2,900 homes were destroyed by fire in Santa Rosa. That's 5% of the housing stock in a city already grappling with a housing emergency. Meanwhile, recent reports of illegal price gouging have exposed massive rent increases that have left even fewer options for fire victims. There's a hotline and email on the district attorney's website to report any price gouging. Santa Rosa officials say the housing situation is so dire, as many as 8,000 residents will leave Sonoma County. In Berkeley for KPFA News, I'm Corinne Smith.
Sunny and warm today in the San Francisco Bay Area, highs in the mid-80s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny with highs in the upper 80s. I'm Max Pringle. News returns at 8:30 on KPFA.
It is 8:08 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I am Kat Brooks.
And I'm Brian Edwards Teeker. Turning to local news. Yesterday, there was an eviction of one of the many homeless camps that has cropped up in Berkeley and really around the Bay Area amidst the housing crisis that we're in. It's interesting because Berkeley for the past several months has been following a policy of not evicting encampments. There are pretty good kind of public policy arguments for not doing that. A concentrated population of homeless people is actually easier to deliver services to. You know, if you think about like dealing with the Hep A outbreak that's been moving through Southern California, if you've got a bunch of people in one place, you can get them a porta potty, you can get them a hand washing station, you can make vaccines available to them. That's a much smaller lift than like looking in every doorway and under every bush for the people you need to reach.
Right.
But camps, not terribly popular with their neighbors. And this one happened to be not on land that Berkeley had full jurisdiction over, but land that was owned by BART. This is right where the tracks go underground at 63rd Street as they enter the city of Berkeley. Our producer, Lucy King, was on the scene when it happened. Our intern, Julia Reichard, was doing interviews the night before when the deadline for eviction was approaching. They produced this special report.
Wow, they cleaned this place up really fast. They're almost done.
Kyle Powers is standing on the sidewalk near what used to be his home. He's surrounded by milk cartons, plastic boxes, and trash bags filled with things he's packed in a rush this morning.
Excuse me, sir. Do you mind if we take this tape down right here so we can load up our stuff and inspect this van? Basically, I'm going to just start with all our bedding and our clothes.
Kyle is moving his things into a van belonging to a kind stranger from the neighborhood. Why? Kyle is unhoused and lived in an encampment with his girlfriend Nicole on a narrow strip of grass behind the BART train tracks. He says he stayed here at 63rd Street and Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley for 3 months. But that changed when BART police served camp residents a notice of trespass that gave them 72 hours to vacate. there's another encampment on the west side of the BART tracks between the here and there signs that also received this notice. They were able to secure legal representation and have won a temporary restraining order. So the removal only took place on the east side of the tracks.
So about 5 a.m., these garbage trucks started pulling up and parking. And then 10 minutes later, all the police came and, you know, woke everyone up. I was already awake because I was already packing and getting everything ready. And they told us we had to leave.
Where Kyle's encampment used to be is now a pile of abandoned mattresses, clothes, boxes, and a single stray tent being cleared by workers from BART and the city of Berkeley. They wear white jumpsuits and neon vests and load things into a large truck while police and a few passersby watch. A BART spokesperson tells me there were 18 police officers and 24 maintenance staff from BART and an additional half dozen each of police officers and DPW workers from Berkeley. The place is now surrounded by chain link fences and yellow police tape. Most of the former residents have scattered. Kyle's hoping to stick with his friends from the encampment, but he doesn't know where they're going to go.
We knew we were going to have to move. Most of this stuff isn't mostly all ours, but we are moving it. We just don't know where to go. We thought we were going to be safe here. You know, BART police came by in August, beginning of August, and told us we were cool to stay here as long as we kept it clean. More people came along, and it just got out of hand a little bit. You know, we had about 30 people here originally, and then in the past 3 days, more of them had, you know, left. People had gone to Oakland or farther down, like San Leandro, Castro Valley. But I want to stay in Berkeley because I love this city. I'm originally from Southern California, and I just moved up here in June. So I've always wanted to live here.
There's a number of theories about why this eviction is taking place now. Kyle says he thinks the death of housed Oakland resident Ariana Ruiz 3 weeks ago was a big factor that drew public scrutiny. According to him, it heightened tensions between his camp on the east side and the here-there camp on the west side, which has rules prohibiting alcohol and substance use.
We kind of wanted to stay like loosely affiliated with the here-and-there camp on the other side of the BART tracks. They're on the, you know, they're on the west side. Ever since the death of that woman, they've pretty much almost tried to place blame on all of us over here, that it's our fault that this is happening, that we're getting evicted and everything. And we've had sort of like a bohemian or like laissez-faire type of attitude about everything. It was you were allowed to do drugs over here if you wanted. People were allowed to do pretty much anything they felt like, besides doing something violent or extremely criminal. But as soon as we started moving our stuff on that side, they, this morning, they all started yelling at us on that other camp to get ours, pick up our shit and get it out of there. So, yeah.
How are you feeling right now?
Exhausted, a little bit beat, but, I'll survive,
However, BART spokesperson James Allison says the plans for the removal of this encampment started weeks before the death in the camp.
We've been planning on this for several weeks, 6 weeks or so.
And the eviction itself, was that decided upon jointly with BART and the city of Berkeley then?
I would take issue with the term eviction. This is a removal of people who are trespassing on BART property. But yes, it was done in conjunction with the city of Berkeley. We worked together with them throughout a course of 6 weeks or so to make sure that we did it in a right way, that not only respected the people who lived here and caught in the homeless crisis, but in a way that we were able to protect the property.
Was there any one thing that caused this decision to take place?
Well, I know that the City Council of Berkeley, council members on record of being concerned about some of the activities that took place here. The mayor himself has expressed concern about some acts of violence that have taken place here. There have also been reports of bonfires that have been set in this area. And you can see how close it is to the BART tracks.
How far would you estimate it being?
So the BART tracks are literally within feet of some of the encampments. There is a fence that's about 6 or 7 feet tall, but you can imagine that something could be thrown into the BART tracks in the path of a approaching train, Fortunately, that did not happen. But, you know, we just can't take that chance when, you know, 1,000 people are on a train relying on us to keep them safe.
Is it BART policy to clear homeless encampments?
We do have homeless encampments on our property that we clear about once or twice a month. And this is something that we do in terms of safety. You can see how close this encampment is to the tracks. The difference is that in this particular case, there has been a memorandum of understanding in place since 1969 that although this is BART property, the city of Berkeley has been responsible for maintaining it. So when people began to move in here, we started to work together collaboratively with the city of Berkeley to try to find a resolution to make sure that we not only treated the people humanely and in a way that recognized the fact that there is a housing crisis, but also speaks to our responsibility as property owners to make sure that it is safe and that the surrounding community's concerns are met. I think it's important to understand that when we came out here and we put up the 72-hour notice on Saturday, that we brought along our crisis intervention specialist, and he also works in homeless outreach. That's his full-time job. He came out here. He has been here before and spoken to the people, and we have along with Armando Sandoval, is his name, have provided people as much information as we can to the available resources for them.
Now that the east side encampment is gone, attention now focuses on the west side here, their encampment. Resident Dijon Gooseby says he's optimistic about their prospects for staying.
Oh, on our side, we got court dates scheduled. They gave us an extra week. But we got a court date coming like in 4 or 5 days.
On October 31st, to be exact. He explains that the Here There camp has garnered widespread neighborhood support.
Everybody over there respects the neighborhood. Everybody got support from the neighborhood. They even have people from the neighborhood, you know, that has places to stay, but they coming over there to protest and they sleeping over there with us because they know that we just trying to survive and we not trying to, you know, just be out here not paying rent, doing drugs and all that. It's like we just trying to survive.
And so you feel pretty confident that your encampment will be allowed to continue?
Yeah, I feel confident because the judge already gave us another week. And she said that she was going to give us probably more so than what we have now for as far as like, you know, housing. They're going to bring people from the city over to help us so we can try to get a place to stay. You know, they got people coming over there, you know, helping out with all kinds of stuff. So it ain't just like a homeless camp where we just all just parking in this one little spot and we ain't doing nothing. We got all kind of stuff coming over, the housing people, you know, just, I mean, all the stuff that we need to try to get back on our feet again.
But he says he doesn't think it's fair that the Eastside camp was forced to move.
No, I just feel like it's wrong because I feel like the side that I'm on, it's court ordered, but I feel like the other side is just as much have the rights that we should have. And it just needs a little bit more structure. And I don't feel like it's right for them to kick them out.
Were you surprised that their removal started?
Yeah, I was very surprised because, I mean, I have family on that side. And they don't do drugs. They just trying to just have a place to stay. And they got removed. And I just feel like it's not right because a lot of people over here just ain't doing drugs. They're trying to survive, and they got kicked out of their houses or they got laid off of work. It ain't like they just sitting over here, you know, trying to trespass and do drugs and harass people. They just trying to have a place to sleep.
A lot of people out here don't want to be out here. It's don't have a choice.
Yeah.
Because of the way the economy is, the way the rent keep going up, people need to understand more of what's going on out here in this homeless situation or the situation period, because you could be out here too. Like this fire that just happened, there's a lot more homeless people.
That was evicted former Eastside camp resident James Gregory Davis Sr. And what he's describing is taking place in a city where median rent on a one-bedroom house jumped 66% in the last 5 years. And in a state where in every metropolitan area, at least 30% of households can't afford the cost of housing. And in a country where no single county has enough affordable housing to meet demand from extremely low-income households. For Upfront, I'm Lucy King.
Lucy King produced that with our intern, Julia Reichardt, who helped out with some of those interviews. You know, I live on the block where this eviction happened. You know what's the most striking thing to me? So the big beef some of my neighbors had with the homeless camp was that they were on a plot of grass that neighbors treated like a park. Wasn't technically a park, didn't have posted rules. People would take their dogs there, run them. Some people would take their kids there. Now there's just a giant cyclone fence around that triangle of grass.
So still no park.
Yeah, nobody's getting to use it. And the reason it's there is because the people who'd been sleeping there didn't have anybody to go. Anywhere to go, excuse me. And you see the same thing in downtown Berkeley around Civic Center Park right now. The entire park is fenced off.
Right.
So it's kind of like our policy failures that have led us to a place where we can't house all our citizens are now making us take our own commons away because we don't want to confront their results.
Or shift our thinking to be about that our common spaces should be for the people.
Yeah.
Like, that's a logical... If people... They did this in my hometown of Las Vegas, too, I remember, where they just started shutting down parks because unhoused community members needed somewhere to sleep, and people were like, well, that's my park. That's my park. But in a rational... I know people think there's a radical... In a rational society, a park would be a great place for people to be able to sleep until we find them housing. You see what I'm saying?
Like, yeah.
It's irrational.
No, well, look, I think there's a fair concern to raise that, like, if there's a public space, it should be for everybody, not just whoever gets their tent there first. But until you got someplace else for people to put their tent, or until you have a place where they can have a roof over their head, like, are you going to argue that someone sleeping in a doorway or on a sidewalk isn't encroaching on the commons in the same way?
I mean, I'm a parent. And a pet owner, and there are lots and lots of parks throughout the Bay Area, right? There's other places that folks could go. We've got to get to a place in our society where we're sacrificing minor comforts for our community members who have major needs, I think.
Anyway, that's that. We're going to try to keep track in the story. What happens to the Here There encampment that is still intact on the west side of the tracks in South Berkeley? That is the more political encampment, the one that has been more rigorously enforcing no alcohol, no drug rules, and that is not facing a residential neighborhood, so has drawn less heat from neighbors. And we're going to try to figure out what's happened to the people who've been displaced by that camp. You know, my partner and I had been speaking to several people in that camp because they're our neighbors. We live on that block. A lot of them were working. Just couldn't make rent on a low paycheck, which is a shocking testament to the state of affairs in the Bay Area. Mm. But for now, we're going to get into another issue that is particularly acute for people of not terribly high means, and that is traffic tickets. Pop quiz, Kat Brooks.
I'm scared, Brian Edwards Secret.
You get a traffic ticket that the state penal code says should cost you $100. How much do you have to pay?
$490.
Oh, you cheated!
No, I just remember what you told me before we came on air.
So this is something that came up in a report that was co-authored by the East Bay Community Law Center a little over 2 years ago, where they're looking at the class impact of traffic tickets, and specifically what happened after the 2008 financial crisis, when the state cut funding to courts, and the courts backfilled by tacking fees onto the tickets they were handing out. And one of their attorneys, Elisa Della Piana, helped us break down what a typical ticket looks like. Okay, we will have that audio clip in a second. Here it is, Elisa Della Piana.
If I get a $100 ticket, I am instantly charged an extra $100 for the state penalty assessment. What's that?
That's a good question. That is
Penal Code 1464.
Yes, exactly. Penal Code 1464. Each of these goes to a different place in the California budget. And that one, I believe, I would have to look up the Penal Code section, is just this is how much it cost, the cost of doing business for this particular ticket.
So this is not my punishment. This is just me shouldering my share of the state budget.
Right.
Okay. In addition to that $100 state penalty assessment, I get $20 as a state criminal surcharge.
Right. These traffic courts are technically criminal courts. And so we'll say you have to pay for a little bit of the running of the criminal departments in traffic courts in the state.
But above and beyond the state criminal surcharge, I get the court operations assessment, which is another $40 also to pay for the courts.
Don't you kind of admire the creativity? All of these different things to call, basically the courts need more money?
Then there's $50 for court construction under government code 70372.
Well, you got to have a building to hear the cases in.
$70 for the county fund?
Yep.
$50 for the DNA fund. What is that?
That is testing people who have prior arrests or criminal charges for DNA to then be used in future investigations.
$35 for conviction assessment.
Right. I can't defend that one. Or any of these, really.
Again, that was Elisa Della Piana. So the total there, $490 for a $100 ticket. Plus, if you do not pay immediately, another $300 in late fees. And until very recently, if you didn't pay after that $300 late fee, you got your license suspended. This was leading to a lot of people driving illegally because for a lot of people, I'm told, I bike everywhere. If you can't drive, you can't work. If you can't work, you can't make money. If you can't make money, you can't pay the debt you owe to the traffic courts, which is a really vicious cycle. So there's been some big progress since then. California passed a bill that eliminated license suspensions as a debt collection tool. The courts have changed the rules so that now they have to consider your ability to pay your ticket if you ask them to. And we're joined in studio by someone who made that happen. Teresa Zen is a staff attorney at the Clean Slate Practice of the East Bay Community Law Center and a member of the Back on the Road California Coalition, which has been fighting for traffic court reform. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So, walk us through the nuts and bolts. First of all, how did these changes happen? How did you get license suspensions as debt collection rolled back?
It took many, many years of advocacy by many organizations and by a very strong coalition doing local and state policy reform. And it also took a lot of people coming forward with their stories. It took a lot of people rolling into the East Bay Community Law Center's clinic saying that their license was suspended and they have no recourse, that they were going to be evicted from their home because they could not find a stable job because they did not have a valid driver's license. And so for many years, people were rolling in with those stories. We took it to the state level and made state legislators listen to us. And we published reports like the Not Just a Ferguson Problem report that Elisa was speaking of in that short clip before, and the Stopped, Fined, Arrested report, which showed the severe racial impacts of a system where people who get traffic tickets are largely people who look a certain way, live in certain neighborhoods, drive certain types of cars, and when they can't afford to pay their ticket, it's their licenses that get suspended. So lots of advocacy across many years to allow the changes that you listed to happen.
What was your primary opposition as you were trying to push this forward?
Very luckily, these bills, governor's budget bill that allowed for the DMV to prohibit the DMV from suspending driver's licenses for failures to pay had very little substantive opposition. And I think that was because people at the state level felt the moral imperative to allow people to live a meaningful life, to not be impeded by a debt trap that is created by the state's funding needs, and for folks to be able to get jobs, to drive their children to work, to not feel scared of being arrested when they have to drive illegally. So I think that the opposition is probably going to come in a later fight down the line when the specific fines and fees themselves are challenged.
So what about all of the people who had their license suspended before this got passed? Are they off the hook?
If your driver's license was suspended before June 27, 2017, the day the governor signed that bill, for failure to pay, your license remains currently suspended. And that is because the Department of Motor Vehicles and a lot of courts around the state are interpreting the governor's law to be prospective only, which, of course...
What does that mean?
Meaning that it only operates after June 27, 2017. So there are no suspensions that are grandfathered in, essentially, under the legislation. Now, the Back on the Road Coalition's position is that that is not legal. And that AB 103, the name of the bill, in and of itself requires that a driver's license suspended for failure to pay no matter when the date of the suspension is now unlawful per the governor's passage of that bill.
Have you had a chance to test that in court yet?
It is currently, there are two pathways by which it is being challenged. One is in ongoing litigation against the DMV. And that is in a case called Hernandez v. Department of Motor Vehicles. We've been negotiating with the DMV to try to get the 200,000 people or so their licenses back, and but the DMV has not firmly committed to releasing the hold on those licenses.
Speaking of Teresa Zen, she's with the East Bay Community Law Center, also part of the Back on the Road Coalition in California. And we want to take your questions. If you are wrestling with traffic fees that you can't pay, if you are on a suspended license because of your inability to pay, particularly if you've gotten into that situation recently since the law changed, we'd like to hear your stories about what you are hearing from the courts. Teresa might be able to answer your questions about how to proceed with getting what you owe knocked down based on the new ability to pay rules. The number is 1-800-958-9008, 1-800-958-9008, and we'll take your questions after the news.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. The House has narrowly passed a $4 trillion budget that clears a key hurdle toward President Trump's goal of cutting taxes. The 216-212 vote allows Republicans to begin work on a $1.5 trillion tax cut and move it through Congress without fear of blocking tactics by Democrats. The tax bill is the top item on the GOP agenda and would be Trump's first major win in Congress. Washington State Democratic Congresswoman Susan Delbene said the plan will hurt middle-income Americans.
The Tax Policy Center has estimated that the Ryan McConnell tax plan could raise taxes by an average of $1,209 a year on families earning between $50,000 and $150,000 a year.
GOP leaders overcame opposition from House conservatives unhappy about deficits and debt, and lawmakers from high-tax states such as New York and New Jersey who are upset about plans to curb the state and local tax deduction. The Senate passed the measure last week, and the House endorsed it without changes to move quickly to the tax measure. President Trump is expected to announce today during a major speech on the opioid epidemic that he will direct his Department of Health and Human Services to declare the opioid crisis a nationwide public health emergency under the Public Health Service Act. That's according to senior White House officials who briefed reporters on condition of anonymity. The declaration does not come with specific funding, but officials say it will allow changes such as expanded access to medical service in rural areas. Trump said an emergency designation will give his administration, quote, the power to do things you can't do right now. Iraq's prime minister today dismissed a proposal from the country's Kurdish leaders to freeze the results of their independence vote last month as Iraqi government forces and Kurdish fighters traded fire near the country's border with Turkey. Haider al-Abadi's office released the comments as the prime minister met with Iranian officials in Tehran, including the Islamic Republic's supreme leader. The timing shows the importance Iran has in Iraq and the years since the 2003 U.S.-led invasion. Both both culturally and in the war against the Islamic State group, even as Sunni Arab countries and the United States remain eager to pull Baghdad into their political orbit. The Iraqi Kurdish referendum last month overwhelmingly backed independence from Baghdad. Kurdish authorities held the vote in the three provinces that make up their autonomous region in the northern part of the country. Sunny and warm today in the San Francisco Bay Area. Highs in the mid-80s, lows tonight in the 50s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny with highs in the upper 80s. I'm Max Pringle. News returns at 10 on KPFA.
8:34 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert with Kat Brooks. We're live with Teresa Zenn. She's a staff attorney at the Clean Slate Practice of the East Bay Community Law Center, talking about their new report on changes to court rules and laws in California that make it much more difficult to get your license suspended for inability to pay traffic tickets and that require courts to consider your ability to pay the amount of your ticket. If you've got questions about how that impacts you, if you've got stories about what it's been like dealing with the court system over a traffic ticket, how that's impacted your life, we want to hear from you. 1-800-958-9008. 1-800-958-9008.
Teresa, before we broke for news headlines, we were talking about all of the people who are impacted prior to this being signed into law. Specifically, we were talking about the DMV level, but what about at the county level? Are there counties that are coming into compliance or not?
So many courts are slow to come up to speed. These ability to pay rules were passed late last year, and courts were given 5 months until May 1st to come into compliance with these rules. However, this summer in June and July, EBCLC law students did a phone survey of all 58 counties. Most courts did not yet have a standard practice, even after they were supposed to have come into compliance. Some had not even heard of the ability to pay process. Now, here in Alameda County, we've been working very closely with the court since these rules were passed to develop a robust process in Alameda County. And we're very happy to report that Alameda County has come into compliance, at least with the governor's bill that prohibited the DMV from suspending driver's licenses, in that Alameda County has recently released 87,000 failure to pay holds.
Whoa.
Yes. 87,000 failure to pay holds on all people who've had failures to pay even before June 27, 2017. So that is a big step, and Alameda County Superior Court did that to come into compliance with the new laws, and other courts should be doing the same, as well as the DMV. Now, Alameda County, I think, is a little bit of an outlier for even courts in the Bay Area. We've called courts in Northern Bay Area have told us that our clients will still need to pay the entire fine before their fares to pay can be released from the DMV, which is, according to the text of AB 103, entirely non-compliant. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done. Our toolkit that we just released provides advocates and individuals with the tools to advocate with their court to bring their court into compliance. And we hope people will use it. I'll make sure to send the link over to you all to post on your website after this segment.
Absolutely.
We will definitely link to that from kpfa.org. Should we bring in some callers?
Sure.
All right. First on the line, we have Dave in the East Bay. Morning, Dave.
Good morning.
What's going on?
Well, listening to the program, was really delighted to see some of the progress being made on this issue. It happens to be something that I experienced, and the circumstances are pretty incredible. So I think I'm going to probably have to try to follow up. But, I fortunately kept calling in when I realized how I was being impacted, and eventually was able to speak with someone at the DMV who was close to retirement and who helped me get copies of some information and, a change of driver's license address that never was sent to me in the mail, I guess turned into a failure to pay, then a failure to appear, and ultimately resulted in suspension of the license. The short version here is that I found out afterwards every one of those is a civil procedure that requires, the defendant to be notified in writing. And I never received any of those letters. And when I kept digging after the fact, I found out that there was some pretty interesting stuff on file in the DMV, and that you know, there were errors made on the initial citation that allowed them to process the citation under a different individual's identity. And then I even found a copy of a notice of the, you know, that was required to be in writing, signed by a DMV field agent saying they notified the defendant over the phone. And so there's a whole, you know, sequence of peculiarities that I thought were pretty compelling, especially in light of what we're hearing about now.
So what's your current license status?
Well, it's a suspension, but the impact has resulted in thousands of dollars of past higher insurance costs that were undeserved.
And it's still suspended.
And it's all occurred before the state. No, it's not suspended any longer.
Okay. Gotcha. Teresa Zen?
Well, Dave, I think you identified a major flaw in the way that our traffic ticket system works, which is that defendants are supposed to receive due process. And one of the important forms of due process is notice that they've received a citation, what their rights are in order to fight the allegations in the citation, and where to go, what to do, what the deadlines are. And it sounds like you received none of that. I would urge you, it sounds like your license is reinstated now, but you are dealing with the problem of the mounting debt. And that debt has probably compounded due to the $300 civil assessment fees that get added on for each failure to appear and each failure to pay. So if you are seeking legal assistance, there are good people in the East Bay that are that help people with this type of problem in advocating with the traffic courts and in trying to get your debt lowered to a level that you can afford to pay, which now, according to these new rules, the courts must consider your financial hardship when telling you that you need to pay a certain amount of debt. So you should seek out organizations like the East Bay Community Law Center, Bay Area Legal Aid. Both organizations do legal services in the East Bay, and they might be able to help you.
Hey, Dave, thanks so much for your call. We're going to try to bring through some more people with traffic problems.
Before we go, can I make one more quick statement?
Sure, quick, man.
Sure. I had actually received notices of driver's license renewals and other items in the mail from the DMV to my address while this suspension of driver's license was being processed through a different address. So it was, like I said, a very peculiar set of circumstances where it seems kind of difficult for the DMV and the courts to suggest they didn't know my actual identity and address while I was receiving documents from them, while actions were being taken against me with false information. So anyway, can the lady on the phone remind us how to reach her?
Teresa Zen. You can check out the Upfront website after this segment.
We'll be linking to their traffic toolkit as soon as the segment's over.
Thank you, Dave. Teresa, I want to make sure that I heard something correctly. Insurance increase for suspended license? That happens?
I've heard that happen to a lot of my clients. You know, basically your insurance premium goes up if the insurance company deems you to be more of an at-risk driver. And so obviously your insurance goes up for DUIs and other things like that. When you have a suspended license, no matter what the license was suspended for, I've seen insurance companies increase insurance payments because of that reason. So someone could, get a parking ticket, which leads to an inability to register your car. And now that's something else that we're working on at EBCLC too. If you do not have proper and valid registration, you can be cited for driving with expired registration. Right. And that in and of itself can lead to a driver's license suspension. So it's not bad driving that we're talking about here. It's actually being poor. The basis of that suspension was that you couldn't afford to pay that parking ticket. And so insurance companies increasing premiums seems to be a bit irrational and nonsensical here in that it's not logically related to bad driving.
We're going on in the segment, we'll bring in another caller. I mean, I'm just the way that the fiscal impact just keeps compounding and compounding and compounding,
mm-hmm.
right? In these ways that, you know, so from the traffic fine to the suspended license, now your insurance is higher, right?
It's like worse than a credit card company's license.
It's really, yeah. really, Wow. Okay. Well, let's now...
We're going to go to Sasha, who's on the line, is wrestling with three different tickets from three different counties. Good morning, Sasha.
Hi. So, I have never had a license. That's the first one. But I did have a permit. I got my first ticket while driving with a permit in Humboldt County. Mm-hmm. And I was unable to get back there because I was 17. I didn't have the money, school, you know, life. So that messed me up. I wasn't able to get a license after that, and I have, like, a $1,200 fine from Humboldt. Then here in Alameda, I have a ticket for $742 and then another ticket for, like, $700. Still with no license, and it's like, the total of all the tickets have come up to about $7,000 just from all the fees and I guess, back pay or whatever. And I don't have a job. I'm a stay-at-home mom, and I've been, like, jobless since I became an adult. And so my worry is that I do still drive, mm-hmm. and I have children, and it's kind of hard for me to even pay the tickets back. So is there a way that I can do that? I tried doing homeless court, but they wouldn't let me because I wasn't on social services at the time. So, yeah.
Thanks, Sasha, for calling in. So your situation is actually pretty common from the stories that I've heard at my clinic. Tickets and people with tickets in multiple counties, and especially youth who get their permit but never reach the point where they can get their driver's license, but they get tickets for driving without a license or something like that. And that impedes them very early on in life from being able to drive lawfully, and then stacking on additional tickets, officers stopping them additionally for saying, well, you are driving with your privileges suspended. Let me slap another $2,000 ticket on you. And it's not helping people like Sasha be able to get jobs and support their family. So Sasha, I would say that for the tickets in Alameda County, Alameda County has an ability to pay form, which means that you can walk into court and request that they give you an ability to pay form. On that form, if you can document that you are low income or receiving public assistance, or you don't have the money to meet your basic needs, you don't have more than $250 in disposable income having met your basic needs, you can get up to 50% reduced from those tickets. And as soon as your application is processed, they will remove the hold on your license. And even better, as I mentioned earlier on the segment, Alameda County has taken the additional step of affirmatively removing 87,000 failure to pay holds. You might be one of the beneficiaries of that new action. So I would recommend that you get a copy of your DMV record from the DMV, which involves going into a field office and asking for a copy of your driving record. And bringing that driving record over to an attorney or a legal aid office, if you cannot afford an attorney, to get a consult. Now, Humboldt County is not a county that I work in or am familiar with. EBCLC does have on its website a 58-county guide that tells you, and this is information that was gathered this summer when we called all the courts, that tells you what the county is doing with regards to ability to pay. If the county has a form that you can fill out, and what you need to do in order to get your fine or fee reduced from Humboldt County.
Okay.
And to be clear, every jurisdiction's supposed to consider ability to pay.
Oh yes.
So
every
let's say
jurisdiction.
Hypothetically, we mm-hmm. don't know. Humboldt County hasn't set that up in their court system.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do to get them to follow the new rules?
That's a really good question. In our toolkit, we have sample petitions, sample motions that you can file by yourself without an attorney, or if you have or if you are a legal services advocate or some other advocate, you can file. You can help your clients file. That say to the judge, this is the new law. And these are my circumstances. These are why my circumstances require the application of this new law. therefore, I request this relief. So this petition, these petitions in our toolkit lay out exactly how you can phrase the argument to the court. And so I would suggest that using the tools that we've all put together in advocating with the court. And other than that, the Back on the Road Coalition, comprised of many great organizations up and down the state, is keeping tabs on all that is happening in every county. So there's a contact form. If you are in Humboldt County and you encounter a problem in Humboldt County, there's a contact form on our Back on the Road website, which allows you to contact us to let us know what's going on. And, the Back on the Road Coalition, can sort of, like, regroup together and see which counties are bad counties, perhaps advocate on a county by county level.
Thank you, Sasha. For clarification, so the Alameda County is not notifying people that they've been released. People are going to need to go in and figure that out for themselves.
We just found out about this recently. Okay. So there may be some public relations campaign down the line, but not at the moment, no.
Okay, let's try to get another caller. We're going to talk to Mark from Berkeley. Good morning, Mark.
Yeah, good morning. I think we're dealing with a sort of a national psychology of penalize the offender. I mean, we've seen a lot of this with, like, prison labor and people who get fees for going to jail, and then they have to go back to jail if they don't pay the fees. But, you know, just to share another perspective here, I mean, yeah, I know you can go to traffic court for your first offense. And down here in Berkeley, MLK, we're in a position where we need them to write more tickets because everybody, including the police off-duty, drives 35 to 40 on a 25 zone, painted in the street, big signs. And we've had at least 3 pedestrian accidents the last couple of years. So I would want to expand the traffic school thing to make people have to sit for a couple hours and watch films about how crazy it is trying to cross the street when fools are doing 40 miles an hour. So, I don't know. I mean, maybe more schools and less fines or whatever. I'll take a response on the air. Thanks.
Teresa?
thanks for that comment. And that may well be the case, that there are rampant traffic violations. These new laws don't impact the issuance of tickets or the abatement of traffic violations. These new laws simply say that if a rich person and a poor person get the same ticket for committing the same offense, that it can't be the case that the rich person can pay the fine using their disposable income and their accumulated wealth, and walk away walk away in their life feeling a mere inconvenience, while the poor person remains with their license remains suspended. They are constantly at risk of being arrested, that they are denied jobs permanently for having a driver's license. So I think that there is a sustained fiscal impact on a person's life that lands them in a bit of a debt trap if they can't afford to pay the ticket up front. That doesn't happen to someone who is wealthy. And so these laws don't say anything about the traffic violations themselves. They merely try to fix or ameliorate a two-tiered system that currently exists in California.
Well, I've taken even our prior caller, Sasha, in wealthier homes, mm-hmm. right? If you're 16 or 17, you get a ticket and you come home and, you know, mom and dad may ground you or take the keys or, you know, whatever, but the ticket's going to get paid and you're going to get to go on with your life, as opposed to this woman who's been carrying this, right, out of her mm-hmm. Since she was a teenager into her full adult life. And then, again, this idea about you can't get jobs without a valid driver's license. And then I was in my head going, when you connect that to some conditions of parole and probation.
Oh, yes.
Right? Which are also black and brown folks. And mm-hmm. so then you're back in jail. I mean, I feel like we could really tangle. Yes. And this is a really huge problem yes. for black and brown and poor folks.
Yes. I actually have a personal theory that is corroborated by many studies and statistical reports that show that in areas with a heavy police presence, there are a higher rate of driver's license suspensions, of police stops that maybe start with something like a broken taillight or not stopping before you make your right turn, and ending in an invasive search of the person's person and their car. And that over the years, this has led to just a culture of discrimination, of racial discrimination, in communities that face this heavy exposure to police contact.
Now, this is actually a policing strategy. I mean, they call it pretextual searches. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
It comes from the broken windows theory of policing,
yes.
basically that higher Bill touch Patton. Policing is going to lower crime, but then
right.
it has incredible collateral consequences.
And we have seen clients at the East Bay Community Law Center that have after getting one ticket, they get 10, 15 tickets after that for driving with a suspended license.
So it snowballs.
It snowballs. People have tens of thousands of dollars in debt. And when they finally are able to get a job by some miracle, their wages get garnished, their bank accounts get levied, such that the prospects of wealth accumulation are almost none.
Let's try to get one more caller in on that point. Steve's in Oakland. He's a job developer at CalWORKS. Mm. Morning, Steve.
Hi, this is a great show. Thank you for having this. I love the Marxism. I'm one myself, but I love these shows where you're actually helping actual people. I'm a job developer in East Oakland with CalWORKS people, and this is the biggest barrier. I think it's the biggest barrier is people not having a valid license. And people come to me with stories of $4,000 or $5,000 of fines and penalties, and I just wish that we get this word out and that you could train, your guests could like train those of us who are job developing and working with CalWORKS recipients or people with barriers because of background issues, and it needs to be a movement that, you know, people need a license. If you've got a license, you can get a job. Mm-hmm. And it's really sort of a form of keeping people from jobs, I feel.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks for that call, Steve.
I actually saw an article recently that said that warehouses or jobs from in warehouses were growing exponentially. And what are those jobs in warehouses? You drive forklifts. You do delivery. And these are good jobs that are being closed off to people without driver's license.
And they often hire formerly incarcerated people,
yes.
those jobs. So a lot of times they're the only jobs that formerly incarcerated people can get.
Because they're not public-facing jobs.
I mean, I don't know the theory behind, but mm-hmm. that's where folks can go to get work when they come home. And so if you add this added barrier, again, it's that circle. Mm-hmm. Then you got to go tell your PO, I don't have a job.
So interesting. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Teresa Zenn, thank you so much for coming in to talk with us and to help some of our listeners out.
Thank you for having me.
Teresa Zenn's a staff attorney at the Clean Slate Practice of the East Bay Community Law Center. You can look them up. They've just released a new guide called the Ability to Pay Toolkit. It's for navigating your way around how to take advantage of the new court rules and the new state rules regarding license suspensions and getting traffic tickets knocked down based on your ability to pay. We'll also link to that report from our website, kpfa.org.
And that does it for today's show. Upfront airs weekday mornings at 7 a.m. We post information about our topics and our guests online at kpfa.org, where you can also dig through our archives, subscribe to the show as a podcast, and connect to us on social media. If you want to yell at Brian about something he said or suggest something for us to cover, send an email to upfront@kpfa.org.
And if you want to yell at Kat, send an email to potus@whitehouse.gov. Our producer is Lucy Kang, with help from Deanna Martinez. Engineer is Kirsten Thomas. Interns are Samantha Shadrow and Julia Reichard.
Our hosts are Brian Edwards-Tiegert.
And Kat Brooks.
And Salima Hamirani.
She'll be in tomorrow.
Indeed. And big thank yous to Mitch Jesuits and Eileen Alfandari, who contribute to the show. Shout out to the brothers and sisters on the other side of the wall who listen to our program every morning. We are starting a new segment, Voices from the Inside, and we want to hear from you. Please send your letters to Upfront, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way, Berkeley, California, 94704.
That does it. Stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming up at 9.
Listening to KP.